it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
So this morning is the last round of this particular group of teachings. And I'm going to talk about practice today. I'm going to talk about the different forms of practice. But let's just briefly review some of the stuff that we've been talking about. Emptiness, interdependence, okay? Empty of separation. That's the teachings of emptiness. Empty of isolation. Empty of separation. Everything is interconnected. Everything is interdependent.
Yeah,
I did. Thank you for reminding me, though. Buddha nature, our true nature, which is this interdependent, vital reality that is who we are at root and what everything else is. This kind of dynamic, expressive reality. That's our true nature. That's Buddha nature. Sometimes known as thusness. We talked about thusness. The twisted nose. I am thusness and you are thusness. Ouch! Yeah. That reality, that pointed reality of that moment. We also talked about practice realization, which is going to be really two things that are very important to remember in our discussion of how we actually enact these teachings, which is what practice is enacting the teachings. Our practice realization, we talked a little bit about that, where when Dogen says, we do not have Buddha nature, we are Buddha nature. It's real in this moment. We don't become something else. It's not about becoming something. It's about being what you already are. So when we practice, we're enacting the teachings and we're remembering who we already are. One moment of practice is one moment of realization. And that is the same for somebody who's been practicing for 50 years and somebody who's been practicing for one moment. That's challenging for us because we think sequentially, right? We think we get better and better and better. And that's true. We do. But fundamentally, when we remember who we are in that moment, that's a moment of awakening. And that's the same for everybody. So there's no hierarchy of practice in Soto Zen. You don't do something else later on. You do the same thing every day. Okay. And the other thing that's important is this: the way we think about faith in Soto Zen. It's not faith in, you know, faith is in the teachings to begin with, in some idea that this has some efficacy, you know. Why bother otherwise? Why not go take a walk or sleep in or whatever? There's got to be some fundamental sense that there's something in it for you. Even though we say no gaining idea, even though we say this very moment is Buddha, regardless of whatever, there has to be some sense that you have an affinity for the teachings, that they mean something to you, that they work. So that's a kind of faith. But fundamentally, faith is this kind of active living out of the practice. That this, you know, it's like unreasonable in a way. It's like this very mind is Buddha. This one. This cranky Buddha. This busy Buddha. This story Buddha. This, yes, this one. So there's a way in which, because Zazen is the enactment of Buddha nature, when we sit down, we have to have some sense that that's true, that we have faith in that, and that that's the enactment of the teachings. Okay? So it's a wee bit challenging. This way of understanding practice the spirit of Soto Zen. Just already are returning, remembering, coming back to is the spirit of Soto Zen. That we are an expression of reality as it is. We are awakening. I was walking, you know, I like to walk down to Capitola Village, and I was looking at the waves and looking at the ocean, and there's this teaching that's actually goes earlier than Zen teachings. It goes back to earlier Chinese teachings, that about the analogy that the wave is the ocean, right? But in a way, the wave starts to think of itself as separate, something else besides the ocean, and like turns around at the ocean and looks at the ocean as if it's something else. That's what we do sometimes. We think we're something else other than reality. How could we be something else other than reality? Is there another reality? Is there another self besides the one you've got? Is there some other? No, according to the Dharma, there's nothing else besides this, and this includes everything. So then I was thinking about effort and coming to know right effort is a very process that takes quite a while, I think, for most of us, because we get very like the little engine that could, you know, I can. We're very grim, very serious. I'm going to do this thing. And that's not the spirit of practice, but we tend to get a little aggressive, do you think, sometimes? So I was looking at the waves and I was thinking, one of the mistakes we make is that the wave thinks, boy, I got to work really hard to get to the shore, right? The ocean is depending on me to get to the shore. Do you ever think that way? Ever think, you know, or all these other waves, man, they're not as good as I am. I'm really doing it right. I'm a big wave, or I'm a long wave, or I'm a, you know, this comparing mind, this mind that's based in conceiving of yourself as something other than you are, which is completely interconnected reality. So we can have a sense of humor about our grimness, about our habitual tendency to think that it's up to us. Because in fact, we do have to make an effort in this practice. You know, it is not the same thing to lay on the couch snoozing all day as it is to actually engage yourself in your life. Get up and take a walk. Pay attention. It takes effort to be kind. It's easy to be cranky. It takes discipline to be kind. Right? It takes discipline to pay attention. Now remember, discipline means, according to David Stendhal-Rash, brother David Stendhal-Rash, discipline means following what you love. It does not mean beating the crap out of yourself. It means identifying what is your deepest value and staying as close to that as you can. It comes from the word disciple, which comes from the word pupil, by the way, which what David said was, it means staying so close to that which you love that you can see yourself reflected in their eye. So for him, this is Jesus Christ, right? This is his life's journey as a Christian monk, is to follow the teachings of Christ. So we follow, we identify what is most precious to us, what really is the force of our life, and today we're talking about the Buddha Dharma, and we practice discipline by staying close to that, by remembering that, by coming back to that. And the practices that we do are a way of doing that, and they express that intention. So this is the dignified activity of a Buddha. Practice is the dignified activity of a Buddha. It expresses our fundamental nature, our awakening. Dogen says, this practice is Buddha studying Buddha's way through our practice. And it is Dharma, the way all things are, studying Dharma through our study. When we sit, it is not just us sitting Zazen, but Zazen sitting Zazen. Our practice is Buddha's life. It is the manifestation of Buddha. So what is Buddha? Buddha is awakening. Bodhi means awake. Buddha means awakened one. So our practice is the practice of awakening. Zazen sit Zazen. yes, you're the one that gets to your cushion and sits down and puts yourself in a certain posture and goes to your chair or lays down on the floor, walks around, whatever you do, you're the one that does that, not somebody else. But it's the activity of awakening that's actually manifest in that. And we come to actually experience that. I want to say one other thing about this is a quote from Katagiri Roshi, who was a wonderful Zen teacher in the United States. He taught in the United States and he wrote many lovely books. Through directly experience human life, we build up character, allowing us to be generous, tolerant, compassionate, kind, and strong. This makes us free from human suffering, even though we are in the midst of it. Our presence is very important for all sentient beings, whoever we are. If our life wobbles and is shaky, it is difficult to be present from moment to moment. So we must be stable when we are around people. We cry, we struggle, we despair, and we have difficult experiences. But those experiences inspire and encourage us to live in peace and harmony. Okay? So the idea is not that we're going to deliver ourselves to some special realm outside of this human world. That's not the point of our practice. The point of our practice is to come back to as much as we can, not wobble, but to be present for ourselves and other people in the midst of this life. If you lose someone, or if you lose a precious pet, or you lose your job, or you are going to have responses. You are going to grieve, you are going to cry, you are going to have despair. You are going to feel these things. Just in the same way, if you win the lottery, you'll be happy, right? It's not that we escape these dimensions of our humanity. Instead, they return us to connection. They return us to awakening. We become big enough to embrace it all. So this is this fundamental, as I said before, we are not liberated from the conditions of the world. We are liberated to them. So I want you to have a sense of these as we go through the different dimensions of practice so that you can feel what the basis of them are. So the first practice I want to talk about is Zazen, seated meditation, that thing. But first I want to read you one more quote. Are you up for that? Okay. This is Dogen. This is the founder of our school. Those who regard worldly affairs as a hindrance to Buddha Dharma only think that there is no Buddha Dharma in secular world and do not understand there is no secular world in Buddha Dharma. Okay, so there's no escape. Whoever you are, whatever you're doing, that's the Buddha Dharma. You know? It's not special. It's not someplace else. This is essential to get the spirit of the practice. Those who regard worldly affairs as a hindrance to Buddha Dharma only think that there is no Buddha Dharma in the secular world. They do not understand that there is no secular world in the Buddha Dharma. So this is the spirit of it. The practice of Zazen is central. So on the one hand, we have this big field of practice. We say, whatever you do, you're going to work, you're in the grocery line, you're doing that. This is practice, and I really want you to get this. And in this school, there's an emphasis on Zazen practice. So what is Zazen practice? It's not learning meditation. It's not perfecting something. It's not delivering yourself to someplace else. It includes every possible dimension of human experience that you could imagine, because when you sit down and pay attention, you will see ever more clearly your own greediness, your own distractedness, your own anger, maybe you'll have bliss, maybe not. You know? I was teaching once at Gompo Abbey, which is a Pema Chodron's monastery, and this woman said to me, she raised her hand and she said, "What do you do with experiences of bliss?" And I said, "I don't know." What we say is, you know, it's just another experience. Okay, so, yeah, bliss, that's great. Did you wash your dishes? So you sit there and you're distracted. Okay, that's fine too. You just keep coming back. Zazen in Soto Zen is called Shikantaza. Shikantaza. Shikan means just, or simply, or directly. And taza means sitting. So Shikantaza means just sitting. You just sit down. I think it was either Katagiri Roshi or Kobunshino Roshi that said, you have a heart. If you're doing something hard, it's good to sit down for a while. You know? So that's what we do when we sit zazen. But we have a very particular way of doing it. We do not desire to become a Buddha. We do not set up standards of, I'm going to have this experience or that experience. We sit in this particular form, so I'm going to show you that. The way we sit, and I'll talk cross-legged first, we sit with our legs, I can't do full lotus or half lotus, so if you can see somebody that can, you plop your legs up here, or you can put your legs in front of you. It's good to have your knees and your rear end form a tripod, so that it's stable, and we say, if you can't get your knees to the floor, bring the floor to your knees. So, my knees are, as I get older, I'm going to use a little cushion to support my knees, so you can use cushions or whatever, so that you feel like you're stable. And your back is erect, not rigid. You know the old story of, you know, your mother ever told you to have a string going up to the ceiling. And yoga's very good. Yoga's very, very helpful for establishing a sitting, good sitting posture. But you lift your head up. Let your shoulders relax. You know, feel your belly. Let your belly go. Breathe. Your mouth should be closed, and your tongue should be on the roof of your mouth. Your eyes are open, but gazing softly downward and unfocused. Right. So your whole mind and body is receptive. Your eyes are not going out, you know, which is an interesting project, right? If you're looking at a wall or the floor, you can say, "Oh, look at that little snake there." We do that. We make meaning. Okay? You sit, you think about your grocery list, or the project you have to have done for work, or something that's very compelling to you in your life. And you just let it go. And you just come back to your breath, and you just let it go. Some people will count their breath to 10 and then start over. The point is, you're just paying attention to reality as it is in this moment, whatever it is. That's it. That is the activity of a Buddha, awake to reality as it is. If you can do a cross-legged posture, great. But there's no excuses if you can't. You can sit what's called seiza, or with your knees folded under on a bench. That's a good way to sit. You can sit in a chair. If you sit in a chair, it's good to, like, you basically have the same position with your body, but your legs are just folded down in front of you. Okay? Your hands are like this. Okay? So you rest one hand in the other, and your thumb tips are touching. And your thumb should be about at the level of your navel. So you shouldn't, it shouldn't be like this. It should be like this. So you're relaxed. This is called the cosmic mudra, by the way. The idea is that energy kind of goes through your body. So if you're sitting, even if you're sitting that way, sometimes people strain their thumbs, especially if you have arthritis in your hands. So you should do what works for you. But that's the fundamental posture. And then you say, well, what do you do with your mind? Okay, I got my body in shape. What happens with my mind and my heart? Dogen said he talks about think not thinking. Our minds habitually think, right? We come up with ideas, we figure things out, and there's a time and a place for that. That's great. Or we can think we want to suppress thoughts or emotions or whatever. That's not correct either. That is actually actively not good for us to try to put a manhole cover down on our minds and hearts. Instead, as one of my friends said, the mind secretes thoughts like the stomach secretes gastric juices. It's just what it does. So we don't have to worry about that. Just don't worry about it. The heart has emotional responses to things. It's what it does. We're not trying to become another kind of being. We're human. So think not thinking means let it be. You have a thought, let it go. An emotion grips your heart, just be present. You know, you're grieving, you're angry, you're bored, you're whatever, just whatever it is, that's what it is. To do this is a sacred act. To be present for reality is a sacred act. It's investing your life with meaning, and it's remembering who you are and letting go of all your ideas about who you think you should be. One of my favorite Buddhist scholars, Anne Klein, talks about the idolatry of ideals. The idolatry of ideals. I really like this. It's like we come up with these ideas of who we should be or what we think should happen, and then we make an idol out of it and we worship it. And it's often accompanied by aggression and judgment and tightness and grimness. It's the wave thinking it's got to work really hard to make it to the shore. Let it go. In this moment, when you sit zazen, just let it go. This is the activity of a Buddha. So you can do this, you know, for here we sit, 20 minutes before we start to talk. Usual period of zazen in a temple is like 30 to 40 minutes. If you can sit zazen for 5 minutes, that's great. Don't feel like you have to sit for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 570,000 minutes. If you can actually stop in your life and sit for 5 minutes, that's an accomplishment. So part of what I want you to leave here today with is a sense of confidence in your own ability to do this practice. This is really important. And you look back and you say, well, what can I do right now? I've got 3 children under the age of 8. I'm working. You know, I'm taking care of my elderly mother. 5 minutes is what I can do. I worked with a woman. She talks to me regularly. She lives in Washington, D.C. And she had 3 very active children. Full-time job. And parental people to take care of. Her zazen practice was the time it took for her to get out of her car in the afternoon after work and walk to the front door and put her key in the front door. For a while, that's what she could do, walking meditation between the car and the front door. So we have to always look and see, how am I skipping out on my life by not making time for this? And what's the actual reality of my life that I can do right now? Okay? So I want to totally give you permission to create in your life spaces where you can sit zazen. And if you can sit regularly, it's very important to do it regularly if you can, every day. And if you can stretch it to 15, 20 minutes, that's really good. The point is to do it. It's like exercise, right? To do it. So this zazen is a complete engagement of body, heart, and mind in this moment without judgment and without seeking anything else. Do you think that's easy? No. It's not. It takes discipline. It takes love. It takes dedication. So Dogen says, do not suppose that what you realize becomes your knowledge and is grasped by your consciousness. Although actualized immediately, the inconceivable may not be apparent. Its appearance is beyond your knowledge. So we want to know things as human beings. We want to nail things down and we want them to be graspable and understandable by us, right? We want, don't you think we have a tendency to do that? We think our experience of something is real, is the reality of it. But what Dogen's saying is, realization is beyond your knowing. We rest in realization. We don't own it. We participate in life. We don't claim it. So this is a certain kind of feeling of the self's relationship to reality, to our days, right? We can set the burden of responsibility for all of reality down and participate in it. And this is what we do when we sit zazen. He also says, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas. So we don't notice that we're Buddhas. We think Buddhas are something else. But he's saying we need to dissolve these notions of what it means to be realized, to express realization. One moment of practice is one moment of realization. Joko Beck said, there are no enlightened people, there are only enlightened moments. And I really like that. That means enlightenment is equal opportunity employer. You don't have to become some special being. And it also means that you can express realization in one moment and be completely deluded in the next. This is very important. Because otherwise we set up some kind of hierarchy of being. It's not only unhelpful, it can be downright dangerous. So our goal is not to pick up this self and deliver it to a state of supreme ease. It's to wake up in the life we have, and in that, ease becomes more apparent. We begin to taste a kind of way of living that's not so driven. So this is the spirit of Shikantaza, and the form of it is what I showed you. And another good form to talk about is walking meditation. And if you haven't had zazen instruction, I would encourage you to come sometime and actually have zazen instruction. You can talk to Steve about it if you want. But in zazen, you hold your hands like this. You make a fist out of your left hand and hold it with your right hand so that your body is relaxed and you're breathing in the same way, full body breath, but not special breathing. Whatever your breathing is in that moment is what it is. Same in zazen. No need to do anything special. And then you just take one step with each breath, slowly walking, So this form is good if you want to do, if you have trouble with seating meditation or you want to extend your meditation and you're sitting and then you can get up and walk for a little while and you can sit. Also, if you're not looking anything, doing anything with your hands that are special, this is kind of stealth meditation. You can do it anywhere. You can be walking down the street and actually be practicing Zazen. Just aware. You will need to focus your eyes, though, so you don't stumble or fall. But just to be aware. Just to take a few moments when you're walking someplace and be aware. So another important dimension of Zen practice is work practice. This is very important. In a Zen monastery, the head cook, the tenzo, is senior position, and the kitchen is considered to be equivalent to the zendo. So work practice is very, very important in Zen practice. We don't work in order to be able to sit. You work in order to work. That moment is completely alive and completely practice. Same as sitting on your cushion. In talking about the tenzo, Dogen says, the way-seeking mind of the tenzo is actualized in rolling up your sleeves. So rolling up your sleeves is Zazen practice, is Soto Zen practice. And we do that with the ingredients. There's a wonderful book called Refining Your Life or Zen in the Kitchen or something. Anyway, it's by Uchiyo Maruishi. And I think it's called How to Cook Your Life. So it's taking the instructions for the tenzo and applying it to your everyday life. So one of the quotes I like in particular, there's a couple. Handle one leaf of green in such a way, if you handle one leaf of green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha, this in turn allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. Understand that a simple green has the power to become the practice of the Buddha, quite adequately nurturing the desire to live out the way. Never feel aversion towards plain ingredients. As a teacher of men and heavenly beings, make the most of whatever greens you have. Do you know where the bathroom is in the back? There's water. Do you need some water? Okay. Okay. So that you, when he says, never feel aversion to the to plain green, that's an instruction for your life too, right? Don't feel like, oh, this is just a plain life. This is not anything special. This is not Chez Panisse. This is the local hamburger joint. So he's telling us, don't have an aversion to all of the elements of your life. Taking care of each thing manifest the Buddha in your life. Each thing. And this is quite ordinary. There's a layman Ho said, miraculous power, marvelous activity, drawing water and carrying firewood. This is the miracle of our lives, right? Miraculous activity, picking up the phone. Miraculous activity, driving our car. Miraculous activity, cooking asparagus. That is kind of because it's very expensive now. So, but this ordinariness infuses Zen practice. And Zen practice infuses your whole life. Dogen says, when you find your place where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. When you find your way in this moment, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. Accordingly, in the practice enlightenment of the Buddha way, meeting one thing is mastering it, doing one practice is practicing completely. So if you're awake at work and you answer the phone with care and alertness, guess what? That's Buddha answering the phone. This is ordinariness of our work practice life. Cooking, sitting, raising children, cleaning toilets, going to work, driving your car. Zazen, work practice. And this is all included in this relational reality. Remember, we talk about interdependence. So this is another very important element is our relationships with all beings. We are of all beings, so we can't help but be in relationship, because how could we not be? We often talk of Sangha, so in Buddhism you take refuge in Buddha, we say true nature, you take refuge in Dharma, in the teachings, and you take refuge in the Sangha, the community. So community, Sangha could be, Sangha is us right now, but it could be the group of people that you practice with, but it's also your family, your co-workers, it's all beings. The fish in the sea, the birds, the possums, everything. This communal, Soto Zen is very much emphasizes relationship and the communal. And joyfully participating in relationship, coming awake to relationship, and this can be very difficult, can it? Because sometimes relationships are really hard. You know, someone's angry, or they're not doing what we want, and to be awake to that, to be responsive to that, can be deeply, deeply challenging. What do you do when it gets tough? You come back to the teachings, you come back to your body, you come back to your intention, you come back. And you show up with honesty and integrity and awareness and kindness. This can be deeply satisfying. So, again, Dogen says, he compares monks coming into a practice period together as milk and water. So we should work together like milk and water, which means you pour milk and water together, and what happens? It becomes one thing. Right. Or he says it's like crossing the ocean aboard a single boat. Initially, the members may enter into the community individually, but gradually they realize that they are born of the same common root. Hence, they are not an assemblage of isolated individuals, but children and flowers of emptiness. So we are flowers of emptiness. We arise, we blossom, we pass away, together with all beings. So when we experience ourselves and others that way, there's a quality of cherishing, isn't there? Quality of engagement. Suzuki Roshi called relational life potato practice. He says if you, the best way to clean potatoes, dirty potatoes, is to put them into a sack together and shake them up, and they knock the dirt off of one another. So communal life, family life, relational life is potato practice. We knock the dirt off of one another, or we polish our hearts in relationship to others. We polish our hearts. So difficulties, struggles, limitations, all of these are opportunities. Challenges, ways to wake up to our true nature, to the interconnectedness, and not necessarily the way we would like it to be, but the way it is. This is the work of a lifetime. One aspect of this is the teacher-student relationship, and I'll just say a little bit about this. Dogen calls it responsive communion, which means that teacher and student are engaged in following the way together. So Zen teachers, in case you haven't guessed, are not gurus. I am not a guru. Zen teachers are practicing with you and function as guides, function as embodiment, function to people who have been on the way for a while. So we are in this together. And it happens in all interactions. This relationship, sangha and teacher, peer, everything, we're all practicing together. So we have this feeling of engagement together. And we also have one-on-one discussions. So if you want to come and see me or see Shinju, you can contact us and we will talk to you. We'll meet with you. We will help you. as best we can. Realize the Buddha way. That's the point. That's what we're here for. All of this together, this relational life, is guided by the Bodhisattva precepts. So this is another dimension. There's a whole history of how the precepts developed, but in our way, they're, you know, these fundamental principles of taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. We say refuge is not hiding, it's not going into a cave. It's something that strengthens our heart. It's something that uplifts us. Something we remember that helps us, engages us. So we remember our true nature when we take refuge in Buddha. It's like, oh yeah, right. We remember our relationship with all beings in Sangha. We remember the teachings in Dharma. So the precepts are basically non-harming. We aim not to harm. We aim to do good. We miss the target a lot, but that's our intention. And live for the benefit of ourselves and all beings. Not to kill. There's a whole series of them. And they're very interesting to engage with and ask deep questions. The study of them forces us to ask deep questions. But they support us. They're not commandments. They didn't come down from heaven. They grew out of the communal experience of Buddha's first disciples. A group of human beings got together, figured out, you know, it's better if we don't steal from one another. It's better if we don't kill one another. It's better if we don't slander. So it came out of human experience to figure out how to live together. So the point is not perfect adherence. That kind of mind can be very, very rigid and grim and judgmental. And that is the complete opposite of the spirit we want. So it's not perfect adherence. It's just a caring returning. Lay people and ordained people in Soto Zen take the very same precepts. We have a ceremony that Liz is going to take in April where we take the precepts publicly. Publicly we say, okay, you can count on me to try my best to follow Buddha's way, to not kill, not steal, not harm other beings, best I can. So if I'm doing those things, I give you permission to come and talk to me about it. Tell me. Right? So that's the basis of this. It's called Jukai. And you sew one of these. Every stitch in this, you sew this by hand, and every stitch, you take refuge in the Buddha. So it's a practice in and of itself. And you poke your fingers, and maybe you're not very good at sewing, or you have trouble with your eyes, and you have to be forgiving of yourself. And then whoever gives you the precepts gives you a Buddhist name, right? And then if you decide you want to do the priest bit, you publicly affirm a special obligation to carrying on the tradition and serving the community. And then you sew a big one that wraps around your whole body. And each stitch. And your mind wanders and you say, oh, I can't believe I want to be a priest. I'm so distracted. Stitch. Boy, that person really bugged me this morning. Stitch. How can that be? So that's what happens when you do something like this. It's another dimension of practice. It's a way of making it real. And lastly, I'd like to talk about the forms and rituals that we do, because this is a very important part of Soto Zen. They're not extra. And what I've noticed, is that forms and rituals can kind of bring out fear and rigidity, you know, or a lot of fear sometimes. People are afraid they're going to do it wrong, You know, like there's one way to do it, and they'll come into a zendo and they'll say, ooh, I gotta do this right. And, you know, I was head of the meditation hall at Tassajara, our monastery, for a while, so I was in charge of all the forms. And I had the opportunity one year, Koben Shino Roshi came and stayed with us, who, and he had been, you know, at Eheiji, which is the mothership in Japan, right? Dogen Zenji's teachings. He knew more about rituals than could be imagined. And he had such kindness and sense of humor and precision. And I was like, okay, I gotta do this right. You know, I'm the one that's in charge. I was very rigid. Very embarrassing. But he taught me the spirit of the, a little bit, of the spirit of the rituals, which is care. We care. We express ourselves through our bodies. It's easy to understand rituals as a mindful activity. So if you, for example, in traditional Zendo, you would always cross a threshold with your right foot, right? So if you're supposed to cross the threshold with your right foot, then you have to pay attention to your feet, right? What's my right foot? What's my left foot? You know, if you get on your zafu and off your zafu in a certain way, you have to pay attention. So it's easy for us to understand rituals as mindful activities. It's also easy to understand it as a way for a group of people to act in harmony. So we're quiet when we enter a zendo. You know, we get up, we turn around and get up in the same way. It helps everything move smoothly, right? It supports one another. So that's also a part of it. But I believe the most important part is that the forms teach our body directly about the practice. When you put your hands in gassho, something happens. Body, heart, and mind are not separate. When we do something with our body, it impacts our heart and mind. We put our hands together and we bow to another. That expresses something, doesn't it? When we do chanting, we chant together as one voice. We say, chant with your ears. We chant together as one voice. When we bow to the Buddha, we're not bowing to some other elevated being. We're bowing to our true nature. When we offer incense with care, we're offering something to all beings. When we do a full prostration, we bring our head to the floor. We raise our hands up. We're raising Buddha's feet above our head. I have a friend who said, that's the only time in the day that my head is lower than anybody else's. Right? So there's something about these practices that teach us something. In Zen, we have a way of eating called orioki, where we put out the bowls. I mean, you can imagine, it's like tea ceremony, right? Can be very elaborate. You set the bowls in a certain way, you chant, you eat in a certain way, and it can be a little bit daunting at first, like, oh, you know, I put the spoon down first, I pick up the chopsticks, what do I do with this, how do I do that? The point is not to be frightened by it. The point is to learn from it and to be taught by it. And the bowls teach us something. They're teachers to us. They're not just things that we use to be mindful. They're actually beings in and of themselves teaching us something. This is how we relate to things from the point of all being is Buddha. Then this bell or my toilet or whatever is also a teacher to me. Everything is our teacher. So we have a certain kind of relationship, and the forms express that. So the point is not to be intimidated, because there are no lightning bolts. Nothing's going to harm you if you do it wrong. We have a sense of humor. At least here we do. Some places are a little weak on the humor side. But we're pretty strong on the humor side, because you know what? We're all just, you know, monkeys in this circus. And we have, so we have forms and services that we do after Zazen. We have a service where we chant and we do bows on Friday mornings. We have a special service where we honor people who are struggling with illness and we wish for their well-being. And we chant the names of people who have passed and honor them in that transition. We have ceremonies like Buddha's birthday or like the Jukai ceremony that we're going to do where someone takes the precepts. We have a New Year's celebration. So there's ways in which we come together to be together, return together, because part of the practice is being with people here or wherever who share a common value of waking up. It can be very, very encouraging to one another to struggle together as human beings and enjoy one another together as human beings with the intention to wake up. And then lastly, we study, which is what we've been doing the last 4 weeks, right? We've been considering what the teachings have to tell us. We think about things, we study, we read. There's so many wonderful books on the Dharma now. You know, they're just amazing. Really good ones. I noticed, I think you were reading Pema Chodron's. Yeah. You know, those little books you can get. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh's wonderful, wonderful books. Suzuki Roshi. And then you can get more. You know, you can read about the Heart Sutra. You can read about things. But the point is to make it real. So study is, we study in order to practice. We don't study in order to concoct elaborate systems that we carry around on top of our head. We study in order to encourage, to nourish ourselves, to remember, to help feed ourselves in our practice. So one more quote from Dogen, if I may. Sutras are the teachings of the Buddha, right? Dogen says, the volumes of the sutras are the bones of the Suttāgata, the bones of the Buddha. The volumes of the sutra are the bones of the Buddha. Because this is so, bones may be the sutra. Even if we know the volumes of the sutra are bones, if we do not know that the bones, our bones, are the volumes of the sutra, that is not yet Buddha's truth. The human world, the heavens above, the ocean, space, this land and other realms are all forms, are all volumes of the sutra, and are bones. Receiving, retaining, reading, reciting, interpreting, and copying bones, we disclose realization. Isn't that cool? I love that. When we study our bones, when we study our life, we're studying the Buddha. We're studying the sutras. So study means, yes, read, study. You know, read Pema Chodron, read. There's just wonderful, wonderful things to infuse our lives with. But also study your life. Pay attention to your bones, the bones of your life. And try and bring all these dimensions of practice alive with the teachings that we've been talking about these last 4 weeks. Make it real for yourself. Gently, steadily, make it real for yourself. And that is following the Buddha way. Okay? So I think I'll stop right now. And